Shoshatyatma Shatagata. Pritu Pritu Parakramaha. Pritu Pritu Parakramaha. So, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So let's take a look at this. Tatra tatra girastasta iti visuta vikramaha shoshatyatma shita gatha pritu pritu parakramaha. So the first line is tatra tatra, which literally means there and there. Or Prabhupada translates it here and there. It means everywhere. Tatra tatra. That throughout the world, tatra tatra. Giras, tasta. Giras means voices or words, speeches, and so on. Tasta, so the repetition of tatra tatra and tasta means it's all over the place. It's not simply in one place, or, you know, it's not that Prithu had his political base somewhere and people liked him. But everywhere you go, tatra tatra, and varieties of praise. Iti, and so iti in Sanskrit is translated thus. It also is used as the quotation marks in Sanskrit. So iti means because of that fact, because of the fact that his glories are being heard everywhere, or will be heard everywhere. Therefore, he is called Bishruta Vikramaha. So that grammatically, Bishruta Vikrama here refers to King Prithu himself, because the top line, all those words, Gidas and Tasta, are the feminine plural in Sanskrit. Those grammar lovers out there. That's the feminine plural, so Gidas goes with tasta, and then Bishruta Vikrama is a masculine singular, which refers to Prithu, whose name will be given at the beginning of the last line. So iti, because of the fact that his glories will be heard everywhere, and all, many different glories, therefore he is called Bishruta Vikrama. So V in Sanskrit is the opposite. It's a little handy little prefix, V, which is the opposite of sum. Sum means together, like sankirtan. And V means apart, the opposite of sum. Sung, by the way, we still have in English through the Greek. The Greek spelled S-A-M as S-Y-N, which they pronounce soon, sum, and we have it in words like synthetic, synthesis. Synthesis means the together thesis. Or symbiotic means when biological things are working together. So the Sanskrit S-Y-N or S-Y-M, according to English, Sunday actually, anyway. I could explain all kinds of things here about Sanskrit grammar and how it even is reflected even Sunday in English, but maybe rather than make this a Sanskrit grammar class, we better get back to the verse. So the opposite of sum together is V, which we still have. For example, in Italian, if someone wants to say get away, they say via, via, which means away, which is what it means in Sanskrit. So because V is the opposite of sum, it has various meanings. So that V, for example, can indicate something which is categorical. In other words, not all merged together, but separated categorically. And because it means away, it can also mean away in the sense of off the real point, like not where it's supposed to be, but it can, in the sense of deviation, as in, for example, vikarma. So vikarma means karma which is deviant, in the sense that it goes away from the real point. So in that sense, V has different meanings. And here, it has another common sense of V, is away or separate in the sense of widespread. It's not simply one place, but it expands. And you find that use of V, for example, very prominently in chapter 7 and 10 of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna talks about his vibhutis. In fact, chapter 10 of the Gita. In chapter 7, you find some verses in chapter 10, most of the chapter, in which Krishna describes his glories. For example, of mountains, I am the Himalayas, of warriors, I am, of the Pandavas, I am Arjuna, and so on. And so, so Krishna calls all these glories where he identifies himself in a certain ontological sense with the best item of all these major categories of existence. And Krishna summarized this, actually, if you read chapter 10, before Krishna gives this list, and then afterwards, in conclusion, he says, what I'm going to tell you, and then at the end of the chapter, what I just told you was my vibhutis. And so bhu in Sanskrit is the verb to be, and bhuti is just a simple word meaning being or existence. In Sanskrit, you can form feminine nouns from verbal roots by adding ti, as in shruti, bhakti, smriti, and in this case, bhuti. So vibhuti means existence that expands. Remember, sun means all together, and v means separate, which can also mean the sense of expansion. And so vibhuti, Krishna's vibhutis, means the expansion of his existence, how he expands his existence into many different spiritual and material objects. And that's why all those identity verses where Krishna identifies himself with so many things in the Gita, it's called the Vibhuti Yoga chapter, because Krishna himself calls all these glories as vibhutis. So it's that sense of V which we have here in this verse. That's why I did all that. I just gave you the scenic drive there. And so here we have the word shuta. Shuta, of course, is a simple Sanskrit past passive participle, which means heard, that which is heard. And so vishruta means that which is heard widely. And that's why the word vishuta or vishuti can mean literally heard widely, or it can simply mean glory, sometimes translated as glories. Prabhupada translates it as chivalrous activities. But literally, vishuta, another very well-known use of V as expansion in the sense of greatness is, of course, in the famous name of Krishna, Trivikrama, which in Western Sanskrit is Trivikram, which you may have heard. Anyway, so tri, of course, means three, and because Krishna took three wide steps, he's called Trivikrama. Krama means step. Trivikrama. That's where that name comes from. So it's in that sense of V, as in the word vibhuti or vikrama. For example, in Mahabharata, if you read the Mahabharata in Sanskrit, one of the ways, Karna is trying to convince Duryodhana to stop being so sneaky and just go out and fight like a man. And so he tells Duryodhana, vikrama, in other words, step wide, like step out, be a man. That's kind of Sanskrit for man up. Anyway, so here in this line, vishuta vikrama, the preposition, v is used twice in that same way. Vishuta, because his vikrama, literally his wide steps, or his bold actions are vishuta, are heard widely. In other words, they're famous. That's a common way in Sanskrit of saying that something is famous. It's vishuta, heard widely. So his vikrama, his wide steps, his bold, or Prabhupada says, his chivalrous actions are vishuta, widely heard. And the reason that his vikramas, his wide steps, his bold actions are widely heard is because the speeches about it, or the talking about it, the giras, tatra tatra, is all over the place, and tas ta, various glories. So, because of that fact, this verse is proceeding logically. Because of the first line, the second line is true, and because of the second line, the third line is true. And what the third line says is shoshatyat mashata gata, that Prithu himself will hear. Shoshati is just the Third person, singular, future tense of the verb to hear, true, which is shoshiti, he will hear. Literally, he will hear. He will hear all these things. Atma shita gata, he will hear songs or speeches, or Prabhupada translates gata here, narrations, songs or narrations, which atma shita. Thank you. So, Atma means himself, because Atma can mean, it's just like in English, the self, in serious philosophical discourse can mean the self, the spiritual self, or it can just be the reflexive pronoun, like in a self-service car wash. So if they had a self-service chariot wash in ancient India, it would be called Atma Seva, self-service. So the word Atma is used like that in Sanskrit. And here we have Ashrita. Ashrita means like sheltered, like Ashraya can mean shelter in the sense of holding on to something, but in that sense it can also simply mean related to something. In other words, something which is connected to or linked to something else. So it can be used in the sense of sheltered, like you hold on to someone else, or it can simply mean something is linked to something else. And that's the sense we have here, Atma Shrita, that he will hear these songs or these narrations which are about him. It's just a way of, in Sanskrit, of saying he will hear songs about himself. Atma Shrita. And then, Prithu, finally, the person, of course, we're talking about in line 2 and line 3 is Prithu, whose name means wide in the sense of broad or expansive, immense. And if you make a feminine form of Prithu, as in Prithvi or Prithivi, of course it means literally the wide earth. So the word Prithivi, which as you probably know, if you know anything about Indian languages, Prithivi means the earth, and literally the wide earth. The wide earth or the great earth. And so that's just the. So Prithivi or Prithvi is simply the feminine form of Prithu. So Prithu Parakrama. Oh, and you can stay if possible. Just. Anyone have a little. I'm just kidding. It was a joke. So, just kidding. So, Parakrama, Prabhupada translates here as distinctly powerful. And again, we have the Parakrama can be grammatically, it can either be Parakrama or Para-akrama. But in any case, it means like a great or supreme or transcendent or powerful step. And also in English, for example, you can say we need to take serious steps here. And so even in English, the word step can mean a process or measures or and so it's like that in Sanskrit. So krama can mean a step in the sense of measures or taking action. So here, because if you take, like, we need to take steps to do something, it means we need to take action to do this, systematic action. And so in that sense, parakrama means, so having described Prithu as Vishuddha Vikrama, now he's described as Prithu Parakrama. There's all kinds of interesting poetic things going on here in this verse. The Bhagavatam is, from any point, even from a so-called material point of view, a work of literary genius. So here you have, for example, Prithu here is a synonym of the prefix V. V means wide or expansive. That's what Prithu means. And so he was called, his actions were Vishruta, and now they're called Prithu Parakrama, which it's a very interesting play on words here. So because Parakrama, in a sense, can be synonymous, roughly synonymous with Vikrama. Powerful, expansive steps, actions. So all this is going on in this verse. It's very brilliantly composed. So tatra tatra giras tasta iti bishuta bikrama shoshatyatma shatagata pritu pritu parakramaha. So I told you, I warned you, I would really go over the word for word. So Prabhupada makes the point here that he's talking about reputation, and he's comparing a genuine fame to mere conceit. He's contrasting these two. So he says, to artificially advertise oneself and thus enjoy a so-called reputation is a kind of conceit. So as we know, there are, on this planet, roughly 7 billion people who are trying to promote their own reputation. And the number of people who are not trying to promote their own reputation would be like a little footnote. Because after all, that's why the soul comes to this material world. Prabhupada often said, to lord it over. And what's the use of lording it over if no one knows you're the Lord, right? That would be really frustrating. And therefore, those who want to lord it over really are concerned to let everyone know they are the Lord. And of course, there's different strategies to lord it over. You can become a great artist, musician, politician, military hero. You can be very rich. You can even, frankly, you know, one possible strategy would be to become a big leader of the Hare Krishna movement. I'm not saying that the big leaders of the Hare Krishna movement have selfish desires. I'm just saying we have seen people become big leaders and then sort of go down like a jumbo jet in flames. You know, it's just... And so you say, like, how could this happen? How could one rise to an apparently high position and then turn out to be not so advanced? And it's interesting because if you look at any society has values, otherwise people wouldn't bother being a society, right? So, I mean, the very fact that people agree to live together, the fact that either explicitly or implicitly they agree to a social contract, which means there are certain benefits you get by living in a society, but you have to pay for those literally through taxes, and also you have to sacrifice a certain amount of your freedom by following laws. If you live out in the wilderness, there are no traffic lights, there are no taxes, and you can do whatever you want. You can put clothes on or not. If you live way out, well, actually, since Australia is quite wilderness rich, let's say if you go far into the outback, so you have complete freedom. No one can tell you anything. The only problem is there are no comforts. You know, no running water, no electricity, no one, no association. So if you live by yourself, you have all this freedom, but it's pretty miserable and lonely and crude. It's a very crude life. So people choose to live in communities and cities in which you have less freedom, but a lot more facilities. And so that's the implicit social contract whenever you choose to live among other human beings. So the way societies and communities maintain themselves, their values, is by punishing what they consider to be misbehavior and rewarding desirable behavior. The punishment takes place, by the way, in two ways. The punishment takes place either legally, by actual legal punishments, or if something is not legally forbidden, punishment may take place simply by social rejection. For example, it's not illegal to be obnoxious. But if someone is somehow inspired to be incredibly obnoxious, the result will be they will have very few friends. People will criticize them. People will not want to be with them. And so sometimes society punishes simply outside the legal system, and sometimes there's actual legal punishment. But in either case, there are negative consequences. And if you do something good, sometimes society will legally reward you, such as by paying you, for example, by doing public service, and sometimes extra legally simply by praising you. You have a great reputation. Actually, there was a tragic case of a man who got both punishments. What is Rolf Harris? He was a big Australian hero, and then he committed a crime. Now he's in jail or something. So in any way, what I mean to say is that since living being, the reason that punishment and reward are effective is because by our very nature as souls, we seek pleasure and we avoid pain. And therefore, the fact that, I mean, that's what pain means. Pain a priori, by definition, means something you don't want. And pleasure means, by definition, something that you do want. And therefore, every society seeks to promote and maintain its values by punishment and reward. And since we naturally gravitate to pleasure and we gravitate away from pain, even in ISKCON is a society, it also must maintain its values and it must punish and reward undesirable and desirable behavior. Otherwise, it would simply basically collapse as a society. And so there are legal punishments such as expulsion, suspension, or somehow we always seem to use the Catholic word excommunication, which means no one's going to talk to you. So, and of course, there are non-legal punishments such as people don't like you, people criticize you, and so on and so forth. And there are rewards where you may actually be given all kinds of facilities, or people may praise you. And so what I mean to say is there are certain sociological principles which apply to every society, whether it's spiritual or material, just like because these are the laws of nature. For example, if a karmi, a jnani, a yogi, and a devotee all fall off the same high place, they will all fall at exactly the same speed according to the laws of physics. Anyway, so now, Lord Chaitanya warns in the Chaitanya Charitamrita we have that one has to tend one's garden. Lord Chaitanya compares the heart to a garden, and you water your garden, but you're not only watering your plants, the ones you want, you're also watering the weeds. So you have to weed your garden, and the weeds are material desires, of course, or which sometimes lead to misbehavior. So weeds grow not only in individual hearts, they grow in community hearts, and they can grow socially. There are social weeds. But in any case, if, let's say, someone is a member of ISKCON and they become attached to the rewards which ISKCON gives, because any society, to maintain its values, must reward those who embody and support those values. It's just socially necessary. So someone may become attached to those rewards and want to avoid the punishments of being ostracized or whatever. And what can happen, the weed, this is what the weed is. That, let's say, I'm in a spiritual society and I am attached to the rewards, and therefore, I'm not actually cultivating real bhakti or devotion. I'm actually becoming more and more attached to the rewards. And that's why we see sometimes that if those rewards are suddenly withdrawn, a person may withdraw. So if you ever wondered, like, why does someone suddenly, who appeared to be advanced, suddenly give up the association of devotees, it's because they were running on reward fuel. And when that fuel was cut off, the motor stopped. Whereas if we're actually serving, because we really want to serve Prabhupada and Krishna, that's why we're doing this, then if some material rewards like fame or access to life terminating Mahaprasadam. Krishna actually says in the Bhagavad Gita that food in the mode of goodness is healthy. So I'll leave it to your discretion to figure out how much Mahaprasadam is in the mode of goodness. I don't mean, this is not an attack on the Melbourne Temple. This is sort of, I'm more ambitious in my attack. Anyways, more wide. So, Krishna also says food in the mode of goodness is, it prolongs life. It doesn't curtail it. So, judge for yourself. Anyway, so that's what happens. That's why people give up their devotional service. Not only leaders, but even, you know, even Vedic bottle washers or just anyway, that's why someone gives up their service, because it's kind of like, I didn't come to this movement to become humble or to be humbled. Okay? Because that's basically what they're saying. I didn't join the Hare Krishna movement to be humbled. So, but if you're really here for the right reason, the fact that you may be misunderstood or unfairly treated, someone who really has as the goal of their life to go back to Krishna, they will take this obviously as Krishna's mercy. By the way, this does not mean that we should knowingly expose ourselves to abuse. That's not what it means. So if someone's in an abusive relationship and they think this is Krishna's mercy, well, maybe, but it's also Krishna's mercy. You have enough common sense to get out of there. So when we say that one should take one's troubles as Krishna's mercy, that means after and not before you've done everything humanly possible and reasonable and legal to avoid it. So it's not that we go looking for trouble. For example, in the early days of the Jesus movement, there were some people, obviously, with somewhat abnormal psychologies who thought that to become Christ-like means to sort of martyr yourself. Because there was a time, actually there were many times in early Christian history, when the Roman Empire tried to stamp out Christianity. I'm not justifying the Roman atrocities, but at least their concern in some ways was justified, because if you look at the Roman Empire, it was very modern in the sense that there was complete religious freedom, complete in the sense that if you didn't, you know, do things which were destructive, there was religious freedom, and there was a type of religious syncretism which goes all the way back to Alexander the Great and even earlier than Alexander, which is the well-known idea there's one God who's being worshipped in different ways by different people. And that allowed everyone to live together as civilized human beings. In fact, you find the same statement much earlier than the Greeks in the Rig Veda, where it said, Eko sad bahudha, what's that? Vibhida. You have to get the verb. It's something like hutam. Vedanti, Bahudha, Vedanti. Yeah, admit that there's one absolute, but people speak about that absolute in many different ways. Bahudha, Vedanti. So, Vedanti. So the Middle East, you could say, because of geographical, meteorological even conditions, because much of it was very dry, and so it was hard to have large-scale societies. It was a very tribal society. Egypt, of course, had the Nile. This is almost Marxist, right? The economic conditions, the means of production determine political and social structures. Anyway, Marx was a good historian, just a really bad prophet. So the idea, because they had the Nile, therefore they could have large-scale settled communities, same thing, the Tigris and Euphrates. You can have, you know, the Great Agrarian Revolution, large societies, and anyway. So, but if you look at Middle Eastern religions that came from nomadic peoples, they tended to be very tribal because the people themselves were tribal. And they imposed this tribal sociology, this tribal psychology on their religion. So my God can beat up your God, basically. And we have to make a very key distinction here between tribal monotheism and philosophical monotheism. In the Indo-European world, certainly in India, and even in the Greco-Roman world, you found philosophical monotheism, because philosophical concepts can be shared. For example, the philosophical concept of monotheism can be shared. Many people in different cultures can be philosophical monotheists, but if your monotheism is based on a certain historical event, such as God appeared to our tribe and saved us in a certain way, then historical events, by definition, are unique. Historical events only occur one time, and therefore it's not possible that your unique historical event, that a prophet came, a son of God came, or God appeared in some way, that unique historical event is not shared by other religions that have their own unique historical event. So people who are pre-philosophical, people who are simply not capable of being seriously philosophical, not fanatical, they make unique historical claims, and therefore one religion, you know, they think they have the only religion, all this nonsense. Whereas when you have, and you get tribal monotheism, but when you have philosophical monotheism, philosophical categories and concepts can be widely shared across historical communities, and therefore people are more sane. And so, anyway, because Christians were persecuted, I'm not justifying the persecution. One of the motives was many intelligent people thought they were destroying civilization by introducing fanaticism, religious fanaticism. There was some truth in that. Although, again, I'm not justifying the persecution. And therefore, they were persecuted, and some Christians, trying to be Christ-like, turned themselves into the Roman authorities. Like, hey, you know, why not crucify me? And because then they would be Christ-like. This Krishna says, austerities which harm the body are in the mode of ignorance. So that's the point I wanted to make. And then getting back to ISKCON, the logical point here is that you should take suffering as Krishna's mercy, but don't go looking for trouble. There's enough trouble that will come to you anyway. Now, of course, Kunti Devi says, as a pure devotee, let my sufferings come again and again so that I'll remember you. She's a pure devotee. So if you were on the spiritual level of Kunti, you can also pray like that. If you're not exactly on the spiritual level of Kunti, that may not be your best prayer. And we certainly should not use this principle to justify remaining in an abusive situation. So, anyway, explained a few points. We kind of went to different places here. Any questions on all these points? Yes.
First of all, we'd like to welcome you to Melbourne. And a very nice, wonderful presentation. My comment is that, as Krishna said in most fundamental part of Bhagavad Gita, Aranyas Chityantu Maam, Ye Jana Paribhaste, Teshami Jyutanam, Yog Shemam Vyamanam. So we have got such a wonderful master. Why we should go astray?
Well, some people in this world are not real bright. And actually, in the question you just asked, there's actually a hidden premise, which I'll bring to the surface. And in other words, your logical argument, or implicit argument, is based on an unstated premise, which is that people generally pursue their self-interest. People do things when it's actually in their rational self-interest to do so. And since it's obviously in one's rational self-interest to join the Hare Krishna movement, you know, why would people go away? And so that premise is actually not true, in the sense that people do not always pursue their rational self-interest. They pursue what they believe to be their self-interest, but their belief is often, well, to be frank, stupid. And that's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, avritam jnanam, our real understanding, our knowledge is avritam, covered. Our real understanding is covered. Avritam jnanam etena. By this, jnani know of the knowing person. He says, jnana, the knowledge of the knowing person is covered nitya varina, by the eternal enemy, by this eternal enemy, which is kama rupena, which comes in the form of lust. Or kama can also mean, more generally, selfish desire. And so when we cultivate selfish desire, it's like taking a stupid pill. And we actually lose our ability to see our genuine self-interest. Abratam Gyanam Etena Gyanino Nityavarino Kama Rupena Kunteya Dushpurena, and which is Dushpura. Just like, you know, Purna means full, like Purnima, full moon, which I'm Western devotees have a very charming way of pronouncing that, Purnim. It's funny, there are three vowels in the word Purnima, and Western devotees manage to get all three of them wrong. So if you're going to mispronounce Sanskrit, do it in style. Anyway, so Purnima actually means full in the sense of full moon. Ma, of course, just an abbreviation for mas, which means the moon. And on Purnamadak, this world is full. So when Krishna says Dushpuram, that our selfish desires are Dushpuram. Purim means in the sense of like fulfilling, right? Like full, fulfill.